Support for Modern Love comes from Living Proof. How long can you...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Go between washes. Keep your hair cleaner, longer, while washing less for beautiful, healthier hair. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Nationally syndicated sex columnist and podcaster Dan Savage is well known for giving advice on any and all relationship issues. But in his Modern Love essay, he asked the complicated questions. This week, Dan Savage reads his own essay, DJ's Homeless Mommy.
There was no guarantee that doing an open adoption would get us a baby any faster than doing a closed or foreign adoption. In fact, our agency warned us that, as a gay male couple, we might be in for a long wait. This point was driven home when both birth mothers who spoke at the two-day open adoption seminar we were required to attend said that finding good Christian homes for their babies was their first concern. But we decided to go ahead and try to do an open adoption anyway. If we became parents, we wanted our child's biological parents to be a part of his life. As it turns out, we didn't have to wait long. A few weeks after our paperwork was done, we got a call from the agency. A 19-year-old homeless street kid, homeless by choice and 7 months pregnant by accident, had selected us from the agency's pool of screened parent wannabes. The day we met her, the agency suggested all three of us go out for lunch. Well, four of us, if you count Wish, her German Shepherd, or five, if you count the baby she was carrying. We were bursting with touchy-feely questions, but she was wary, only interested in the facts. She knew who the father was, but not where he was, and she couldn't bring this baby up on the streets by herself. That left adoption. And she was willing to jump through the agency's hoops, which included weekly counseling sessions and a few meetings with us, because she wanted to do an open adoption too. We were with her when DJ was born, and we were in her hospital room 2 days later when it was time for her to give him up. Before we could take DJ home, we literally had to take him from his mother's arms as she sat sobbing in her bed. I was 33 when we adopted DJ, and I thought I knew what a broken heart looked like, how it felt, but I didn't know anything. You know what a broken heart looks like? Like a sobbing teenager handing over a two-day-old infant she can't take care of to a couple she hopes can. Ask a couple hoping to adopt what they want most in the world, and they'll tell you there's only one thing on earth they want, a healthy baby. But many couples want something more. They want their child's biological parents to disappear, so there will never be any question about who their child's real parents are. The biological parents showing up on their doorstep, lawyers in tow, demanding their kid back, is the nightmare of all adoptive parents, endlessly discussed in adoption chat rooms and during adoption seminars. But it seemed to us that all adopted kids eventually want to know why they were adopted, and sooner or later they start asking questions. Didn't they love me? Why did they throw me away? In the cases of closed adoptions, there's not a lot the adoptive parents can say. Fact is, they don't know the answers. We did. Like most homeless street kids, our son's mother works a national circuit. Portland or Seattle in the summer, Denver, Minneapolis, Chicago, and New York in the late summer and early fall, Phoenix, Las Vegas, or Los Angeles in the winter and spring. Then she hitchhikes or rides the rails back up to Portland, where she's from, and starts all over again. For the first few years after we adopted DJ, his mother made a point of coming up to Seattle during the summer so we could all get together. When she wasn't in Seattle, she kept in touch by phone. Her calls were usually short. She would ask how we were, we'd ask her the same, then we'd put DJ on the phone. She didn't gush. He didn't know what to say. But it was important to DJ that his mother called. When DJ was 3, his mother stopped calling regularly and visiting. When she did call, it was usually with disturbing news. One time, a new boyfriend died of alcohol poisoning. They were sleeping on a sidewalk in New Orleans, and when she woke up, he was dead. Another time, she called after her next boyfriend started using heroin again. Soon the calls stopped, and we began to worry about whether she was alive or dead. After 6 months with no contact, I started calling hospitals, then morgues. When DJ's 4th birthday came and went without a call, I was convinced that something had happened to her on the road or in a train yard somewhere. She had to be dead. I was tearing down the wallpaper in an extra bedroom one night shortly after DJ turned 4. His best friend, a boy named Haven, had spent the night, and after Haven's mother picked him up, DJ dragged a chair into the room and watched as I pulled wallpaper down in strips. "Haven has a mommy," he suddenly said, "and I have a mommy." "That's right," I responded. He went on, "I came out of my mommy's tummy. I play with my mommy in the park." Then he looked at me and asked, "When will I see my mommy again?" "This summer," I said, hoping it wasn't a lie. It was April, and we hadn't heard from DJ's mother since last September. "We'll see her in the park, just like last summer." We didn't see her in the summer, or in the fall or spring. I wasn't sure what to tell DJ. We knew that she hadn't thrown him away and that she loved him. We also knew that she wasn't calling and could be dead. I was convinced she was dead. But dead or alive, we weren't sure how to handle the issue with DJ, which 2x4 to hit him with. That his mother was in all likelihood dead, or that she was out there somewhere but didn't care enough to come by or call. And soon he would be asking more complicated questions. What if he wanted to know why his mother didn't love him enough to take care of herself, so she could live long enough to be there for him, so she could tell him herself how much she loved him when he was old enough to remember her and to know what love means? My partner and I discussed these issues late at night when DJ was in bed, thankful for each day that passed without having the issue of his missing mother come up. We knew we wouldn't be able to avoid or finesse it after another summer arrived in Seattle. As the weeks ticked away, we admitted that those closed adoptions we'd frowned upon were starting to look pretty good. Instead of being a mystery, his mother was a mass of distressing specifics. And instead of dealing with his birth parents' specifics at, say, 18 or 21, as many adopted children do, he would have to deal with them at age 4 or 5. He was already beginning to deal with them. The last time she visited, when DJ was 3, he wanted to know why his mother smelled so terrible. We were taken aback and answered without thinking it through. We explained that since she doesn't have a home, she isn't able to bathe often or wash her clothes. We realized we screwed up even before DJ started to freak. What could be more terrifying to a child than the idea of not having a home? Telling him that his mother chose to live on the streets, that for her the streets were a home, didn't cut it. For months, DJ insisted that his mother was just going to have to come live with us. We had a bathroom, we had a washing machine. She could sleep in the guest bedroom. When Grandma came to visit, she could sleep in his bed, and he would sleep on the floor. We did hear from DJ's mother again, 14 months after she disappeared, when she called from Portland. She wasn't dead. She'd lost track of time and didn't make it up to Seattle before it got too cold and wet. And whenever she thought about calling, it was too late or she was too drunk. When she told me she'd reached the point where she got sick when she didn't drink, I gently suggested that maybe it was time to get off the streets, stop drinking and using drugs, and to think about her future. I could hear her rolling her eyes. She'd chosen us over all the straight couples, she said, because we didn't look old enough to be her parents, and she didn't want us to start acting like her parents now. She would get off the streets when she was ready. She wasn't angry and she didn't raise her voice. She just wanted to make sure we understood each other. DJ was happy to hear from his mother, and the 14 months without a call or a visit were forgotten. We went down to Portland to see her. She apologized to DJ in person. We took some pictures, and she promised not to disappear again. We didn't hear from her for another year. This time when she called, she wasn't drunk. She was in prison, charged with assault. She'd been in prison before for short stretches, picked up on vagrancy and trespassing charges, but this time was different. She needed our help, or her dog did. Her boyfriends and traveling companions were always vanishing, but her dog, Wish, was the one constant presence in her life. Having a large dog complicates hitchhiking and hopping trains, but DJ's mother is a petite woman, and her dog offers her protection and love. Late one night in New Orleans, she told us from a noisy common room in the jail, she got into an argument with another homeless person. He lunged at her, and Wish bit him. She was calling, she said, because it didn't look as if she would get out of prison before the pound put Wish down. She was distraught. We had to help her save Wish, she begged. She was crying. The first time I'd heard her cry since that day in the hospital 6 years before. Five weeks and $1,600 later, we had managed not only to save Wish, but also to get DJ's mother out and the charges dropped. When we talked on the phone, I urged her to move on to someplace else. I found out 3 months later that she'd taken my advice. She was calling from jail in Virginia, where she'd been arrested for trespassing at a train yard. She was calling this time, though, to say hello to DJ. I've heard some people say that choosing to live on the streets is a kind of slow-motion suicide. Having known DJ's mother for 7 years now, I'd say that's accurate. Everything she does seems to court danger. I've lost track of the number of her friends and boyfriends who've died of overdoses, alcohol poisoning, and hypothermia. As DJ gets older, he's getting a more accurate picture of his mother, but so far it doesn't seem to be an issue for him. He loves her. A photo of a family reunion we attended isn't complete, he insisted, because his mother wasn't in it. He wants to see her even if she smells, he says. We're looking forward to seeing her too, but I'm tired. Now for the may God rip off my fingers before I type this part of the essay. I'm starting to get anxious for the slow-mo suicide to end, whatever that end looks like. I'd prefer that it end with DJ's mother off the streets and in an apartment somewhere, putting her life together. But as she gets older, that resolution is getting harder to picture. A lot of people who self-destruct don't think twice about destroying their children in the process. Maybe DJ's mother knew she was going to self-destruct and wanted to make sure her child wouldn't get hurt. So she left him somewhere safe, with parents she chose for him, even though it broke her heart to give him away, because she knew that if he were close, she would hurt him too. Sometimes I wonder if this answer will be good enough for DJ when he asks why his mother couldn't hold it together just enough to stay in the world for him. I kind of doubt it.
Dan Savage, reading his own modern love essay, DJ's Homeless Mommy. We ask the question that everyone is wondering about, where is DJ's mother now?
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
More after the break.
Living Proof products save time. Just ask Tyler from New York.
I have probably been able to save about 30 minutes per day when I use it. I usually shower every morning. My hair gets greasy very quickly. So if I shower one morning and not the next, I cannot go to work like that. So it allows me to sleep in an extra 30 minutes. I just get up, put the dry shampoo in my hair, and off I go, which is amazing.
Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order.
I'm Steve Allman.
I'm Cheryl Strayed, and we're the co-hosts of Dear Sugar Radio, a podcast from WBUR for the lost, lonely, and heartsick.
We take your questions, no matter how deep and dark, and offer radically empathic advice.
Subscribe to Dear Sugar Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. DJ, Dan Savage's son, is now 18 years old. He just voted for the first time and is still figuring out whether he wants to go to college. In the meantime, he is working in a Seattle coffee shop. As for his mom...
DJ's mom is alive and well and living in Portland, Oregon part-time and in a rural area the rest of the time. She does seasonal labor and she's good. She's on her feet. She's housed and... We talk on the phone occasionally, and she and DJ speak on Mother's Day and on DJ's birthday, and things leveled out.
But does Dan have any regrets about keeping this adoption open?
There were certainly issues we had to confront earlier in his life than perhaps parents in a closed adoption might have had to confront those same issues. But DJ is happy to know his mom, and we are happy to know her and happy to have her be in our lives in the small way that she is. And he, I think, benefits from there not being any mysteries and not being any unanswered questions out there, even if it was difficult to answer some of his questions early on when he didn't quite understand the full ramifications of choices that his mom had made.
So would Dan recommend open adoption to future parents?
All adoptions are hard. All childhoods are hard. All parenting involves struggle. I would hate for anyone to listen to that essay or to read it, which was written at a moment of such kind of confusion and despair, and conclude that they shouldn't do the kind of adoption that we did. I think that open adoption is really in the best interest of the child, even if, as I've always said, and said long before the incidents related in the essay.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
It presents more challenges for the parents. The complications are really for the parents, but taking those on and overcoming them is, again, in the best interest of the child. And so I encourage everyone who's thinking about adoption to seriously consider open adoption and not to be dissuaded by my essay.
Dan Savage on his essay, DJ's Homeless Mommy. Dan is an author, nationally syndicated sex advice columnist, and activist. He created the It Gets Better Project, a campaign to prevent suicide among LGBT youth, with his husband Terry Miller in 2010. You can hear him each week on his own call-in advice podcast, the Savage Lovecast. Listen on iTunes or at savagelovecast.com. In 30 seconds, we'll hear from the other Dan, Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Don't go anywhere.
Modern Love is supported by Thinks, a period-proof underwear that replaces tampons and pads on light days and is the perfect backup on heavy days. And yeah, they actually work. Reusable, they're designed to absorb the equivalent of two tampons. They've got built-in technology that wicks moisture, fights bacteria, and keeps you comfortable all day long. What's crazy is that they're super thin and feel like a regular pair of underwear. Curious? We know you are. So go to shethinks.com. That's shethinx.com, and get $5 off with the code MODERN.
Welcome back. Daniel Jones is editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and he says this essay opened up an element of Dan Savage's life that might have been relatively unknown.
We saw this other side of Dan Savage, who is this truth-teller in a different way in public life. And in this essay, Dan is again a truth teller, and the truth is really uncomfortable, as he acknowledges, you know, and he's very forthcoming about saying, I don't know what is the right way to handle this. And the ultimate truth, which comes at the end, is I just need this to end in some way. And wow, what a statement. It's just such a powerful statement of frustration. And how do we deal with this love for this boy and what all these truths might mean to him someday?
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Now, we've featured several stories about adoption on the podcast, each one told from a different perspective, like this one, read by actor Gabby Hoffman.
That first night in the birth suite, when the birth mother had been moved to a postpartum room to give us all privacy, I stared at this miraculous little girl. My partner was dozing on the couch and heard me start to cry. "I can't undo this," I said. "If the social worker comes to take this baby away, we will have to burn our lives down." "Yes," she said, "we will."
We'll link you to all of our adoption episodes on our website, wbur.org/modernlove. Make this week your Modern Love binge week. It's well worth it. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.